Welcome to Honey from the Rock, a podcast devoted to Bible exposition. My father, Jack Christensen, preached expositionally for over 50 years, first as a missionary to Pakistan and later as a pastor in New England. His legacy lives on in me. He often began his sermons with a little expression, and now a little honey from the rock, taken from Psalm 81, verse 16. The psalmist wrote, "I would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock I would satisfy you." Today, more than ever, we need to feed our souls on the words of God in the Bible. The crying need of the church is for God-centered, word-explaining messages. So now, my friends, a little honey from the rock. How should Christians relate to the government under which they live? Church and state, how do they relate? A popular doctrine throughout history has been the doctrine of the two spheres. The government occupies one sphere, and the church occupies another. The doctrine of the two spheres teaches that the two spheres are equal but separate. In Germany, under the Nazis, this meant that Christ was the Lord of the church, but Hitler was the Lord of the state. You were free to believe what you wanted in private, but anything that impinged upon the state's authority was rigidly controlled. The same doctrine of two spheres is being promoted in America today as well. A lawsuit was filed by parents in Cresco, Pennsylvania, against a school district because the school stopped a fifth grader from handing out invitations to a church Christmas party. For many years, there was a white cross on top of Sunrise Rock in the Mojave National Preserve in Southern California. The cross memorialized all those who lost their lives in World War I. A lawsuit was filed against the cross, arguing that it was a public display of religion and therefore not allowed. It crossed the line between the public and private spheres of life. However, the Supreme Court ruled in 2010 that such public displays do not violate the law, thus preserving the right to express our faith in the public square. Justice Anthony Kennedy stated, "The goal of avoiding governmental endorsement of religion does not require eradication of all religious symbols in the public realm." The protections against the two spheres doctrine are tenuous at best. There is incredible pressure to conform to a state that relegates our faith to the private sector only and may see us as a threat to government if we express our beliefs. Yet God challenges us to be transformers in a highly competitive culture. Daniel can teach us much of what it means to be a transformer, not a conformer. First of all, my friends, don't be afraid to walk a different path. Daniel 1, verses 14 to 16. Don't be afraid to walk a different path. We saw in the last study that Daniel and his friends had proposed a test to the Babylonian authorities. They would be allowed to eat only vegetables and water for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they would submit to be tested. If they did not measure up to the other students at the Royal Chaldean Academy, they would accept their actions' consequences. If they did measure up, they would be free to continue living by their convictions. It was a small step, but Daniel was willing to put his faith on the line. He was not afraid to walk a different path than his peers. Small acts of faith bring the smile of God and strengthen our faith for bigger tests in the future. Look at Daniel 1, verses 14 to 16, where we read, "So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were to drink, and kept giving them vegetables." It was time for their preliminary exams. They presented themselves for review. Babylon was a culture where appearance was highly important, and these young men looked good. The Hebrew word means that they were literally pleasant or agreeable in appearance. I want you to notice that Daniel submitted himself to the standards of his culture, and he passed those standards with an A+. We do not know if Daniel agreed with those standards, but he observed them. He was not weird-looking or offensive. He did not appear to be odd. He did not dress like he belonged to some fringe element of society. He fit in. He looked better than his peers by their own standards. He was fatter than they were, meaning he was healthier and even more pleasant than the best of his peers while living on a diet of vegetables and water. So, when I say, don't be afraid to walk a different path, I don't mean that you have to appear to be weird. Pick your protests and live out your faith as a part of the culture in which God has placed you, where God has assigned you. Perhaps this is a good moment to stop and address a popular trend among Christians. It's called the Daniel fast. The idea is that you should periodically fast like Daniel and eat only vegetables and drink only water for 10 days. The Hebrew word translated vegetables literally refers to anything that is sown, so that would include grains. The diet focuses on eating grains, legumes, nuts, fruits, beans, and other vegetables while avoiding all meat, fish, and poultry. However, Daniel and his friends continued this diet for the next 3 years, according to verse 16. Not just 10 days, or perhaps the 21 if you go to Daniel's example in chapter 10. Furthermore, it is clear from chapter 10, verse 3, that Daniel normally, ate meat, like sheep, beef, deer, fish, and chicken, which, by the way, was allowed under the Mosaic law in Leviticus 11. He did not follow a vegetarian diet as a way of life. Now, I have no problem if a person wants to eat a vegetarian diet as a personal conviction or even as a short-term fast, but we should not try to impose that diet on others as if it is some sort of biblical diet. Daniel and his three friends passed their preliminary exam, so for the next 3 years they were allowed to live differently. It had to get around among the other students. Imagine the jealousy and resentment that developed in such a competitive environment, especially when they were so successful. The same thing happens at your job, in your corporation, or your university. You will be immersed in a secular environment and must perform to the standards of your employer or your school. Don't be afraid to walk a different path and still be successful. You may experience the peer pressures of resentment and ridicule, just like Daniel. There must have been incredible pressure to conform. Well, how do we tell when we should and when we should not stand out? And for what? Dick Staub, in his book Too Christian, Too Pagan, raises this troubling issue. In my observation, he writes, Christians are either too Christian or too pagan. The Christians who are too Christian are very comfortable with the Christian subculture, but are ill at ease when in the world. On the other hand, Christians who are too pagan are at ease with the world, but fail to integrate their faith into their everyday life. If we try to reach the world by becoming too much like the world, we fail. If we try to protect our faith by withdrawing into our Christian subculture, we fail. There is a balance, but it is sometimes hard to find, and there is intense pressure to conform on both ends, particularly if we are immersed in a pagan cultural environment like the university setting. The University of Pennsylvania issued a notice to all resident advisors in the dormitories. If you are perceived to be racist, sexist, heterosexist, ethnocentric, biased against those with religions different from your own, or intolerant of disabilities, you must be willing to examine and change that behavior. Did you notice that the entire decision is based merely on perception? You don't actually have to act biased or be biased, but if you are perceived to have a bias, then you are subject to discipline by the Department of Residential Living. It can be tricky, but friends, find a way to walk a different path as an expression of your Christian faith in the university or in the corporate world. That's the first principle. Secondly, don't be afraid to pursue excellence in your field, verses 17 to 21. Don't be afraid to pursue excellence in your field. As for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Then, at the end of those days of testing, which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. He found them 10 times better than all the others. Not only the students, but all that were already serving him. We come to the final exams here. Students, set the bar high for yourselves, spiritually, morally, physically, and academically. Don't settle for just getting by. My friends, set the bar high in your chosen profession. Don't be afraid to pursue excellence in your field. Excellence in the service of Christ is a powerful witness to the world. And there are 3 little principles that I want to apply from this passage to our lives as we pursue excellence in our fields. First, remember the source of your success. Remember the source of your success, verse 17. Daniel and his friends needed to prove themselves in the highly competitive world of the Royal Academy. They worked hard. They were highly intelligent, and they developed their mental and physical skills to the highest levels of success. But hard work and intelligence are not enough. Their success did not come because of their brilliance. It came because God was the sovereign power behind their success. Look at the text. God gave them knowledge and intelligence. God gave them. Never forget that in all of your achievements, in all of your success, it is God who gifts us to accomplish these things. And God does the same thing in our world today. He uses the very belief systems of our culture to point people to himself. He does this just like in Daniel's day, by beating the pagans at their own game. These men came to understand not just some of the branches of the Chaldean educational system, but every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel was particularly gifted by God to be successful in the field of divination or dream interpretations. The Chaldeans believed that every event, whether good or evil, was accompanied by certain omens or other observable phenomena that they could interpret. Divination was the territory of a special class of priests who were required to be physically perfect in every way and went through years of rigorous studies and initiations in order to be able to interpret dreams and omens. God will use this same pagan belief system to prove his power through Daniel in the years ahead. Look at verse 20. Here we read that the king found them better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in his realm. The first word, magicians, referred to one who divined the future primarily through the study of the stars. Astrology. They designed elaborate charts to superimpose on the maps of the stars. These star charts gave them information about the future through the changing positions of the stars during the course of time. The second word, conjurer, meant someone who was a soothsayer. This person studied dreams and omens to determine the future. Handbooks still exist from ancient Babylon that describe these magical arts in detail. Daniel must have studied this material in his education. Clay tablets survive that describe the omens to be observed in the stars and in the organs of animals. They made clay models of sheep livers and inscribed magical formulas on them to teach students how to read the signs. They poured oil on water in a cup and studied the patterns that formed as a means of determining the future. All of these matters raise troubling questions about Daniel. The law of Moses forbade the practice of the magical arts. God had said in his law, "You shall not practice divination or soothsaying. Do not turn to mediums or spiritists. Do not seek them out to be defiled by them. I am the Lord your God." The penalty for participating in the work of mediums was death. God had said, "Now a man or a woman who is a medium or a spiritist shall surely be put to death. They shall be stoned with stones. Their blood guiltiness is upon them." Was Daniel becoming too pagan as he studied these matters? How was it infecting his spiritual life? How does a believer balance faith in God with the practices of pagan idolatry and studying those practices in depth? These are big questions for us today. They certainly were for Daniel. It's very important to notice that the text carefully avoids saying that Daniel practiced these arts. He certainly studied them. He had to. And we are told that the results he achieved exceeded the results of all the other magicians and soothsayers in the kingdom. But, the source of Daniel's knowledge and success is clearly identified. The source of Daniel's knowledge and success was God. God gave him knowledge and intelligence. The results came from God, not their education. This is very important. It is vital. As Christians, we can achieve many things in this secular world in which we live. But we must never forget that our success comes from God and is to be used for God's glory. God wins. He defeats the forces of paganism at their own game. Imagine the final exams for Daniel and his friends. I think it is perhaps useful to use a little sanctified imagination here. Imagine the final exam in astrology, for example. Daniel stands before the king. A map of the stars is laid out before him, and he is asked to interpret the map. Essay number 2. He is told a dream and asked to interpret the dream. Essay number 3. He dissects a sheep liver, and he is told to explain who will win the NCAA basketball championship. Well, what do you think Daniel does? I think he talks to God, and he says, God, I've worked hard, and this is all pagan. This is all idolatry. They think their gods give them this information. I know that you alone can tell the future. So, would you give me that information so I can prove your power in this world? We know Daniel thinks that way because later he will pray very similarly. Well, God gives him the answer. Nebuchadnezzar's mouth drops open with every question and every answer. He doesn't yet understand this unusual power, but he respects it. And that is the starting point for evangelism in a pagan world. Secondly, serve where God puts you, verses 18 and 19. Serve where God puts you. Look at the end of verse 19. And they entered the king's personal service. Literally, it says they stood before the king. Some historical sources tell us that when the king took his position on his magnificent throne, there were live lions chained on either side of the throne to remind those who stood before him that he was all-powerful. Can you imagine these young exiles from the city of Jerusalem standing before the most powerful king in the world? They were hired to serve him. Daniel and his three friends were given high government positions as consultants and advisors to King Nebuchadnezzar. Do you think you experience pressures in your job or in your school? Think about Daniel. He's now about 18 years of age, perhaps 19, and serving as a personal advisor to the most powerful king of a superpower in the ancient world. He didn't choose this career path. Could you imagine Daniel in the palace back in Jerusalem with his young friends talking about his career path? He could never in a million years have imagined this moment. But God has put him here. And I praise God for Christian workers in government positions. We need more of them. It is a daunting task. My friends, serve where God puts you first. God may have plans for your life that you do not understand and you did not expect, and you are ending up somewhere you had no reason to think you would be. We all tend to look at our jobs and wish for greener pastures. Meh, I don't like the pressure. My boss is the worst. The immoral climate I work in is disgusting. I feel like everything I do is just spinning my wheels. It all seems so irrelevant. Well, you fill in the blanks, because the reasons we dislike our jobs are many. Yet God may have you there for a much higher purpose. Consider whom God wants your life to touch where you are, with eternal ramifications. Let's come back to the issue of church and state for a minute, because Daniel faced those struggles in his government position. Serving in government posts can be difficult, especially as a Christian. We all need to remember why we are here, and it is not to change our governments. Daniel needed to walk a fine line between influencing government decisions and being a witness to the Almighty God of the universe. Our job is to be a witness, not change the government. One U.S. legislative aide said after a tour of China a few years ago, "I believe there is a word of caution for us in the apolitical nature of China's underground church. They," meaning the Christians, "they fervently pray for their leaders, but maintain a careful independence. We are privileged to live in a participatory democracy, but having worked in American politics for almost a decade, I have seen more than a few believers trade their Christian birthright for a mess of earthly pottage. We must continually ask ourselves, is our aim to change our government or to see lives in and out of government changed for Christ?" You see, that's our goal. The first element in a strategy for evangelism is to keep the right goal in mind. We live and work to see God change lives through His power, not to see governments changed by our power. The second element in a strategy of evangelism is to be a representative of Christ wherever you are. God has you where you are for a reason. Evangelism takes place out there in the world, not in the church. On the job, in the community, in the schools, that's where God calls us to live our faith. We are living representatives of God to our culture. If you are a teacher in the public school system, be the best teacher you can be. Real evangelism takes place in these settings, not in the church building. The third element in a strategy for evangelism is to be an evangelist more than to do evangelism. Chuck Colson told about his friend Charlie, who went with several other Christians to share their faith with people in Charlottesville, Virginia Bar. They were using a tool called the Four Spiritual Laws, a familiar little booklet designed to walk a person through the gospel message. Charlie struck up a conversation with a nicely dressed young man who admitted his own spiritual emptiness. They developed a rapport. But Charlie sensed that the young man was not ready for a commitment. So he took down his name and number and made an appointment to get together with him again. After they left the bar, one of the others in the group asked Charlie excitedly, "Did you get to go through the book with him?" "No," Charlie replied, "he wasn't ready. We're going to talk again later." The other Christian was furious. "I can't believe it," he exploded. "Here we are trying to witness, and you didn't even go through the book." Well, that young Christian, like many Christians, missed the point. We need to be evangelists before we can do the work of evangelism. As St. Francis of Assisi so aptly put it, preach the gospel all the time. If necessary, use words. Third, be the best you can be, verses 20 and 21. Be the best you can be. These young men were literally 10 times better than the best. Excellence in the service of Christ is a powerful witness to the pagan world. They respect excellence. And what good does it do to tell your boss about Christ if you're a schmuck on the job? How effective is it for you as a Christian teaching in the public school to try and share your faith with your peers if you are one of the poorest teachers in the school? Will they listen to you? Furthermore, be the best you can be for as long as you have to be. Look at the end of verse 21. Daniel was taken captive in 605 BC, and he served kings through three dynasties, five kings. He served Nebuchadnezzar and two Babylonian kings, two administrations of Babylon, who followed him. He served Darius the Mede, and he served Cyrus the Persian. If he began his service in 601 BC, after his training, we know that he was still serving in the first year of the reign of Cyrus in 536 BC. This was the same year when the first Jewish men and women were allowed to return to the land of Israel. So Daniel served in multiple pagan administrations. He served five pagan kings for 65 years. If he was 15 at the time of his captivity, then he was 88 and still serving under Cyrus the Persian king. What would you do if God told you that you would stay where you are and serve him for the next 60 years? Could you be the best you can be for 60 years working for five different owners? If we are always looking for something better, we'll fail to serve God where we are with our very best right now. So goal number one for the Christian is to be the best representative for God that we can be for as long as he wants us to be in the place where he puts us to be. Why? Why? Because we represent God to a culture that opposes God. We are God's representatives to this culture. Billy Graham was a man who lived a Daniel-type life, witnessing to presidents and dictators going back to the days of Harry Truman. He also received a lot of criticism from Christians over the years. For example, he was criticized for praying at both of President Bill Clinton's inaugurations. Philip Yancey spoke with Billy Graham privately about his ministry. He asked Dr. Graham which president he spent the most time with. He named President Lyndon Johnson, a man with whom he had major political differences. He said that President Johnson had a fear of death and always wanted a pastor around. So despite their political differences, Billy Graham spent time listening to him and sharing Christ with him. For Billy Graham, the person was always more important than the politics. During the height of the Cold War, many Christians criticized him for not taking a harder stance when he met with Leonid Brezhnev and the other communist leaders, condemning their human rights abuses. One of his critics accused him of setting the church back 50 years. Dr. Graham listened, and then quietly replied, "I am deeply ashamed. I have been trying hard to set the church back 2,000 years." Spoken like a true Daniel. My friends, how is God calling you to represent him where you are today?